So today is what, March 9th, 2011, and what I'd like to talk about tonight is what are called in Buddhism the hindrances. And maybe I will stand up if that's okay, so I can see you better. You can see me better. Well, in the context for this is that, as a lot of you know, we've been working our way through the four foundations of mindfulness, and now have made our way to the fourth, finally, and which is kind of a catch-all of different topics to investigate and be mindful of. In the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha recommends as a direct path, he says, a one-way path, sometimes translated to enlightenment, he recommends really reflecting on and investigating and bringing awareness to sort of five clusters of topics inside this basket of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And the different clusters are to be aware of the six senses, you know, sight, taste, touch, so forth, and thought. Second, to be aware of what he called the aggregates, which is to say the various elements of reality, notably our experience of reality, including form, the feeling tone of pleasure, pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, perception, all other contents of thought and consciousness. Those are the aggregates. And then he also recommended being aware of the hindrances, which will be my subject tonight, and I'll get to those in a second, as well as the various factors of awakening, which I'll talk about probably when I come back in 3 weeks. And then last, the Four Noble Truths. So these are various themes to investigate. And the key is not so much to understand them, and definitely the key is not about believing them, but rather the key is to investigate them and to use them as skillful means for gradually unwrapping and unknotting the factors that lead to suffering. Okay? So that's the context. And also in that context, as best I can, I try to relate the elements of the four foundations of mindfulness to relationships, because this is, for me at least, and I think in this gathering, a focus for this year on relationships. Relationships both as a field of practice and as a support for practice. Okay? So, what I thought I would do is present the hindrances, just kind of go through what the Buddha thought about them in a summary way, and then if you're interested in doing it, invite you to reflect on how those hindrances operate in your own life, with a partner if you like, otherwise just on your own, and then we'll come on back and talk about it and close to 8:30. Right? Okay. So hindrances, right there is an interesting word, because what does a hindrance do? It hinders you. You're trying to move forward and it slows you down. I was talking with a client earlier today and a couple, and he talked about getting bogged down in what he called the syrup of things. You know, it's that feeling we're trying to progress and it's like we're moving through a field. I have had times in my life where I've been moved towards some kind of self-expression, you know, expressing an emotion or expressing or pursuing an aspiration, and it's like a kind of wall of sleepiness comes over me. This sort of, you know that feeling? This sort of smothering blanket of just more, you know? That's a hindrance, okay? But the key here, I think, is the notion of there's something positive. There's a forward movement that's natural, right? But there's something that's hindering it. So it's a little bit like, I don't know about you, but sometimes at a stoplight, you know, I'll put my foot on the brake, you know, especially if I had my kids in the car when they were younger and I was trying to impress them, and I'll push down the gas pedal, all right, but my foot's firmly on the brake. So when you pop your foot off the brake, go boom, you really blow through that light when the light turns green. I don't know if any of you have ever done anything like that. I have, and I'm willing to admit it and relish it. Not burning rubber, but, you know, zoom, you get going. Well, what happens? So you take off the brakes, and your natural movement pops you forward. And that's the nice thing. When you release the hindrances, that natural movement forward takes over that we can have faith in. Okay? So what are these hindrances? The Buddha identified five. And if they made it to the list of five, you got to figure that to him, you know, a profound yogi, a great practitioner in his own right, you know, really offering to us all many of the very hard-won lessons of his own practice. And also, he's a coach. You know, he's a teacher. He's really trying to teach us what works, basically. So if they made it to this list of five, they're probably worth paying attention to. The first hindrance is, he called it greed. Greed is broadly defined. Basically, it's a kind of wanting, a drivenness. And you can think of examples of that, both as in terms of hindering practice, as well as hindering happiness in general. You know, like really getting driven around certain desires. Or, for example, wanting our meditation to be today as deep and profound as it was yesterday. Or as good as the person sitting next to us who told us about their amazing white light experience last week or something, right? That would be a kind of wanting, a kind of greed. Greed shows up in all kinds of ways. Basically, it's in the transition that we've explored a fair amount here of moving from liking something to wanting it. Right? And being aware of that movement in the mind from the stimulus to the feeling tone of, let's say, pleasant, to a kind of enjoying of it, to a liking of it, to wanting it, to needing it, craving it, and clinging to it. That's when trouble really begins, isn't it? To move through those steps. So being aware of those steps is very helpful. And being able, as best we can, to not tip into that intensity of wanting, and kind of hang out with liking and enjoying. So that's the grief. That's a word or two about grief. All right. Hatred is the second one. Hatred, again, a traditional word. It covers a lot of ground, just like greed. And it ranges from very, very subtle kinds of anxiety or apprehensiveness. It's very helpful to appreciate that fear is in the spectrum of so-called hatred. Any kind of aversion. So fear really belongs there. Subtle anxiety, subtle sense of alarm, subtle apprehensiveness, you know, subtle irritability. How many of you are ever irritable? Oh, well, really, only half of you raised your hands. I want to talk to the other half of you afterward. I want to learn from you. But anyway, irritability is a very interesting thing to observe. You're not quite irritated, but boy, could you be, you know? That's irritability. That's, we can feel that, the sort of prickliness, a preparedness to be reactive, to have antipathy towards something, to not like it. So that's in the category or spectrum of hatred. You know, some things are kind of combos, like envy, if you think of it, which is a really, I think, underrated and powerful emotion, is a combination of sort of greed and hatred. You know, we want something, and we hate the fact that they've got it and we don't. Sort of. Okay. Buddha put a lot of emphasis, actually, in his teachings on the hatred spectrum of things. And comparing hatred to greed in an interesting way, and this came out of a conversation I had with Andy Alinsky, who's a really wonderful scholar and teacher of Buddhism in the East Coast, so I want to credit him for some of this point. On the one hand, it's striking how much emphasis the Buddha put on the hatred spectrum, which I think makes sense because as biological creatures, yes, we want to go get carrots, but we're very reactive about sticks. Because sticks, in other words, pain, threat, loss, etc., poses a lot of urgency and impact to evolving animals. So there's a lot of intensity in neuropsychology around the hatred spectrum of things. On the other hand, as Andy pointed out, and it's a very interesting point, with regard to threats, they're kind of simple. We just got to get away from it. We want to get away from harm, get away from pain, protect our loved ones from harm. It's pretty simple. But the positive things we might like, you know, what you know, really can engender a certain proliferation of thought, you know, because we can make all kinds of complicated plans to go get what we like. We tend to think a lot about what we like, how great it will be to get what we like. There's a lot of proliferation, is a nice term that's used in Buddhism, proliferation of thought around what we like. So you see, in other words, we can get messed up around both, greed and hatred. We tend to get messed up around hatred because of intensity and urgency and a biologically rooted reactivity, and we tend to get messed up around greed because it's this fertile field or just fascination and mall shopping and catalog looking and fantasy and so forth. And we live in a culture that tends to protect us from some of the more intense things that we've hated historically in our evolutionary history, and really has showered us with all kinds of things we could have grief for. Okay? Well, then the rest, I'll kind of move through them a little briskly. The next classic one is called Restlessness and Remorse. That's an interesting one. What in the world does that mean? And those words are translated in different ways. Basically, it means being caught up and upset. We're restless. Maybe we're restless because we're stimulation seeking. That's one kind of restlessness. But a lot of the restlessness is there's some kind of disturbance. There's some kind of dis-ease, unease that's got us going. And maybe it's wrapped up in remorse, guilt, feeling like we haven't been true to some important standard, including not really taking good care of ourselves. It's an interesting way to expand the notion of restlessness or remorse. How does that hinder us in practice? Well, if we're caught up in those kind of preoccupations, it's hard to do practices, like just relax and be with the breath, or to give loving kindness to others if we're caught up in self-criticism. It's hard to sit quietly and meditate if we're physically restless and bored out of our skull because there's not enough stimulation. These are all hindrances to practice. Okay. The fourth one is sloth and torpor. I love those words. Sloth, you know, like a sloth. It's just laziness, inertness, passivity, a kind of, yeah, whatever. You know, it's interesting how many teachers are quite exhortative, and they're quite intense. The Buddha, too, basically says, you know, you never know how long you've got. All kinds of teachers talk about really use the present moment. Don't just lollygag your way along. You know, this is a wonderful opportunity to have a precious human life. There's a, for example, the Dalai Lama, you know, we don't normally think of him as kind of shaking us a little bit, but I wake up every morning and we have some little scroll from in which someone had written down a quote from him right next to our bed. It just kind of hangs there on my wife's bureau, which is kind of neat. She keeps moving it around because she needs to open the drawers. I don't know why. And then I have to put it back where it's supposed to be because that's a form of greed. Things are supposed to be a certain way, right? So it's worth seeing all these little manifestations of greed, hatred, and so forth. Anyway, and in this quote, he says, every day, just a paraphrase, every day when you wake up, you should say to yourself, I am glad that I have woken up. I am so grateful to be alive, to have a human life. I'm not going to waste this life. I'm not going to have sloth and torpor. In other words, I'm not going to waste this life, and I'm going to make the best of it for myself and for the sake of others. Essentially. And how beautiful. So, sloth and torpor shows up in lots of ways. Sleepiness, a kind of lack of energy, lack of vigor and commitment. Think about four words the Buddha routinely uses as the hallmarks of dedicated, sincere practitioners, as standards in a sense, or aspirations, which is to say to be ardent, which is heartfelt and resolute and diligent, all three of which are really the antithesis of sloth and torpor. Okay? Ardent, resolute, and diligent, as well as the fourth word. Yeah? And then the last hindrance after sloth and torpor is sometimes considered the greatest hindrance of all, doubt. Now that one's interesting. Why would doubt be perhaps the greatest hindrance of all? And what does the word doubt mean? Now the Buddha does not mean we should not be skeptical. In Zen there's a term, great doubt, as in a kind of deep inquiry and deep non-attachment to view of one kind or another, and a disposition in practice that holds view very lightly. Holds certainty very, very light. I've seen in my own mind, in my own practice lately in meditating, the power of settling into a space of truly not knowing and not even trying to know. This stuff's happening, stuff. Don't need to know, stuff. Okay? There's a place for that. On the other hand, the hindrance of doubt is where we don't really give ourselves over to what we truly know. We doubt what we truly know. I think a lot of us, if we sat down, if an angel appeared, you know, in your bedroom at night or whatever, you can imagine of that, or the Buddha appeared, or any equivalent, or a dear friend appeared, or your cat appeared, and you just had a very honest conversation about what you know to be true. If Oprah appeared, and you told her, I know these things to be true, what would you say? There's a lot we know to be true. And then we tend to doubt what we know to be true, or we don't act on what we know to be true. Also, doubt is, an aspect of doubt is over-intellectualizing, getting caught up in what the Buddha called a thicket of views, you know, paralysis by analysis would be maybe a modern phrase, you know, related to that. And those are examples of doubt. And one of the, I think, reasons why doubt is considered perhaps the worst hindrance or the most hindering of hindrances is that you can doubt anything. Really, you can just, doubt can be applied to anything. People can get caught up in that. Okay? So any questions or comments so far about hindrances? Well, examples for me are, there I am, I'm meditating, and I'm thinking to myself, for example, should I focus on the sensations of just the breath and really burrow into that, or should I go wide open and just kind of hang out there? Now, well, I could go into the breath, but maybe I should go out here, you know? So if we're kind of doubting what we should be doing, that is a hindrance. Or we doubt sometimes whether we should practice at all. Like, what am I doing at this stupid workshop, and why am I on retreat, and is this a waste of time? Am I getting anything from this practice? Am I gaining anything by the way? It's like self-doubt. Doubt, go on. I think that's very helpful to me, what you're saying, and a way to relate to this would be to imagine for each of the five hindrances, what is its antithesis? In other words, what would be present if that hindrance were not there? Like, for example, if the hindrance of greed is not there, what shines forth? In other words, if you take your foot off the brake of greed, what happens? I think there's peacefulness and equanimity. You know, when you take the foot off of hatred, there's a lot of love. There's a lot of joining with and gratitude for the amazingness of existence. You know, when you take the brakes off of sloth and torpor, you have energy, you have vigor. When you take the brakes off of restlessness and remorse, I think there's a centered steadiness in practice. And then when you take the brakes off of doubt, what there is conviction. Conviction or faith. And I think that might be a way to relate to it, which is, can you give yourself over to what deep down in your heart you know to be true, including your highest values? Like, again, I know for me, awakening is a very, very high value, but I can't tell you I give myself over to it every waking minute. And that is something to ask yourself, you know, what are your own known deep commitments, deep values, and what would it be to truly not doubt them anymore or in any way, to not have any more reservation about them, to not be reserved in any way, but really allow their propulsive force to live through you and as you. Yeah, I think also it's helpful, and we'll get to you, and then we'll maybe do a paired thing if you're up for it. I think it's helpful to know what your own tendencies are in terms of these hindrances. Like, if you know the Enneagram at all, it's a model of personality typing. A six in the Enneagram is a doubter. And I can think here of our son, he's a wonderful guy, but he really has a hard time giving himself over to anything, because he can always think of very good reasons, and he's good at doubt, very good reasons why it may not really work out. So maybe I really should not fully, wholeheartedly invest myself in something. I should not go all in on this particular thing. You might ask yourself, do you tend to be more hindered by greed or by hatred, sloth and torpor? Some people tend to be kind of slothy types. Are you restless and, you know, kind of caught up in anxious preoccupations? That's restlessness and remorse. Or do you tend to be a doubter who kind of steps back and, I don't know, maybe, you know? Anyway, okay, yes. Yeah. Oh, I like that. Thank you. That's very thoughtful. Yeah. Thank you.
What do I do with that?
Ah. Well, I have this. To me, what you're getting at, I think, is something I've never heard anyone talk about, which I think is kind of creative, which is regarding each one of these hindrances as a strategy. Right there is an opening. Like that's, in other words, how is greed a strategy? How is hatred a strategy? How is sloth and torpor a strategy? And as a strategy, this is where I have a theory that's been very useful to me as a therapist and as a personal practitioner for myself. It's this notion of the dreaded experience. And why don't I unpack that a little bit, and then we can maybe look at this a bit. Although I really do want to preserve time for you to pair up and talk with somebody, so I'll be quick about it. So I think what happens basically a lot of the neurotic process has three steps to it. So the structure is the same. It's a kind of universal structure. Not all neurotic process falls into this structure, but I think a ton of it does. It goes like this. Step one is a natural movement of self-expression. In other words, an emotion comes up like sadness or anger or love, desire, or there's a truth that comes out, like how we see it or how we what we want from another person, or there's an expression in the sense of an aspiration. We want to pursue something. Okay? That arises, and then very quickly, typically within a second or less, there is a fear of what would happen if. Right? What would happen if I told you I loved you? What would happen if I told my dad I to say no? I had to actually work really hard to finally say no to my father. I remember very specifically. I did it on the telephone. I was about 24, and I made myself say no to him about something. And that was very hard to do because I dreaded a lot what would happen if rooted in childhood. Right? Okay? In step one, there could be the desire to get close to another person or to invite them to get closer or desire to break away whatever it is, or step back, whatever it is, that's the natural movement of the self in step one. And then comes step two, the fear of what will happen based on history, either experienced or observed in others. That when you do that, it ends in panic. And that's the dreaded experience. Which then leads to step three, which is the inhibition on self-expression of some kind of making a joke, intellectualizing, suppressing it in the body, acting out in some way, drink, you know, getting drunk, whatever it is. You know, there's some form of inhibition on numbing out, getting unconscious, dissociating a little bit. There's some strategy, in other words, in step three, that's about avoiding the dreaded experience. So we might ask ourselves, how could a person use doubt to avoid the dreaded experience of commitment, let's say? Because what doubt does is it undermines commitment. But this general model, which I don't want to dwell on any longer because I want to preserve time for prayers, is for me an incredibly useful model. And very often, where you find yourself in the three steps is you realize you're in the third step, you know, 10 days later, or 10 minutes later, or 10 seconds later. And then you work backwards. Wow, how did I get to this encycling of defense, or inhibition, or maneuver here? How did I get here, right? Well, I got here as a strategy, as a means to the end of avoiding the experience, or avoiding risking the experience that I dread will occur if I just naturally express what's unfolding here. Make sense? I really invite you to look into your experience that way, because the process then, to go to your point of what to do, is to risk the dreaded experience. As you identify the dreaded experience, help yourself to risk it. And that typically means doing that in small graduated steps, you know, working up a kind of ladder, if you will, of intensity and confrontation, and getting support. And when, as it usually happens, you risk the dreaded experience and it goes fine, take in the good. Really internalize the felt sense of, wow, this went okay. My training, my dad was fine with me saying no. He didn't even notice it. Which was awful and wonderful. But anyway, for many reasons, awful. But, you know, usually it goes well, right? When that happens and you disconfirm, to use the fancy phrase, the expectation from childhood, very often infancy or preschool years, childhood, and you disconfirm those expectations of pain, boy, oh boy, that is gold to take in. Okay. Because then you get increasingly free. And the Dharma path is a path of freedom. Liberation. Freedom. Freedom from programming. Freedom from the threads that tie us down, like Gulliver to the hill, all the little Lilliputians in our mind, the legacy of our childhood, and last job, last marriage, whatever, last love affair. It's freedom. It's, we're cutting these threads, we're getting increasingly free.
I thought of what you said the other day, it's about
great, super. See, this has kind of come alive, yeah. Oh, you too? Okay, hang on one second. Okay, okay, good. Yeah? Huh?
Oh, I was just going to say, all of this talks about the need to be all of this, the need to be
That's very nice, thank you. Well, how about this, if we're up for it, and maybe we'll just, because I do want to try to end in a more timely way, regularly, closer to 30, how about we pair up if you're up for it, and then we'll come back and pretty much end after that. Sound okay? Because then it gives you really a chance. So here's the inquiry. You'll pick, in a moment you'll pick a partner if you want to do it. There'll be an A and a B. A's go first. One person mainly talks, one person mainly listens. We'll do it about 3 or 4 minutes each way. And basically, I invite you to explore the hindrances in general, or maybe even better, pick one. So really go into it. You know, you only have 3 or 4 minutes. Pick one that you think is really ground zero for you, both as it hinders your formal practice of meditation or other practices, whatever they are, as well as in general hinders your movement to cut the little chains of suffering. Okay? And then I'll give you a time signal and you'll switch. All right, so how about you grab a partner? If you want one. If you want a partner and don't have one, raise your hand. Okay, pick an A and a B. Okay, good. And yeah, threesomes are fine. How great. Okay, A's begin. Just explore one of the hindrances, or more than one if you like, in your practice and your life. Begin. One more minute. Thank you. Okay, A's, wrap it up. And then switch roles. B, it's your turn to explore that hindrance. Begin. One more minute. Okay, start wrapping it up. Thank your partner. So to finish here, in the interest of ending in a timely way, I thought we could finish in a very brief little guided reflection for a couple minutes here. So where you are, maybe just kind of be aware of yourself. And then open to one or more positive things that would be there for you if you were not hindered in this way. What's the positive thing that would be more present or more powerful or emerge, gas pedal, that would come forward if you were not hindered? And see if you can open to that and allow it, this positive thing, to blossom in you, like a flower opening inside you. Sort of marinating in this positive feeling, or factor, or knowing, resolve, whatever. Sort of marinating, opening to it, giving yourself over to it. Thinking into it. Sensing that it is sinking into you. Thank you for your practice. Go forth unhindered.